This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Changes to tax thresholds and a promise to scrap the two-child benefit cap. In this Moneybox podcast, we'll find out what was in the Scottish budget. If you're a pensioner missing out on the winter fuel payment this year, we'll look at what other help you could get if you're struggling. Plus, how many insurance policies does your fridge freezer really need? What about your phone? We'll ask if you're spending more than you need to on cover. But first, 9 out of 10 charities say they've had at least one issue with banking in the last 2 years. Charity Finance Group and the National Council for Voluntary Organisations spoke to almost 2,000 people from charities in the UK. They found more than three quarters said they had struggled to change the named signatories on their bank accounts. 4 in 10 said the checks they were asked to complete weren't designed for voluntary organisations. Now, this is an issue we often get emails about here at Moneybox, including one from Dave. He's a trustee for the Roma Project, which is a charity in the West Midlands that supports the Roma community. Their founder, Bernie, sadly died, leaving them unable to use the charity's bank account. Dave got in touch with Moneybox and we stepped in.
We basically relied on Bernie Flatley, who was our hero. He set the project up. Tragically, he passed away unexpectedly in August this year, but he was the only one that actually had a mandate to make any transactions from our business account. So when he passed away, we were just stuck in a position where we couldn't pay the staff, we couldn't pay the rent for the premises, and our business account was just locked down.
Yeah, because you cannot be the only small charity this has happened to.
No. So it should have been a very simple mandate change. But we ended up in this sort of doom loop, is the only way I can describe it, where they knew we were a charity, but we had an account that was called a community account. And for some reason, they couldn't get past making the mandate change without these historic changes to the account being made first.
How difficult was it for the charity being unable to use its money in this time?
I've never experienced anything in my life. It got to this crazy situation where I ended up having to use my own personal savings to pay the staff their salaries. We were just at the point of collapse financially and collapse emotionally. It was unable to work myself and unable to get anywhere. Without your help this year, I don't even think we'd still be existing as a charity. I would say I'd spent 3 or 4 hours every day getting nowhere. I emailed you. We had a brief conversation. Within 20 minutes that morning, I had somebody on the phone taking personal responsibility for it. But for it to be so difficult to do something that should have been so simple was just so frustrating.
Well, I'm very glad that with Moneybox's help, that charity was able to get access to its account again. But what about all the other charities? Well, listening to that is Claire Mills, Deputy CEO of Charity Finance Group and co-author of this report. Claire, Dave told me without our intervention, his charity might have had to close. That just shows, doesn't it, the impact these banking difficulties can have. How common is what he experienced?
Well, Felicity, sadly, I'd love to say it was an outlier, but it's not. In our survey, we had over 2,000 respondents and over 200 people told us they'd had problems with their bank freezing their account or they were unable to access it. And actually, listening to Dave there, 264 people told us that they'd been told by their existing bank they had the wrong type of account and needed to open a different one. So it's not uncommon. It is ridiculously common and it shouldn't be happening.
Okay, well, Moneybox contacted the bank, and as we heard from Dave, he had a phone call 20 minutes later. We obviously can't do that for all the charities that you've spoken to. You have made some recommendations for banks, especially around communication and awareness. What do you want to see?
Well, first thing we'd really like is around knowledge and understanding. We find that banks and financial institutions just don't have the knowledge of, admittedly, the complex range of governance structures and operating systems that charities can use. But it's not hard to educate ourselves on that, and we can help with that. And one thing that would really, really help charities and charitable organisations of all kinds is if the banks and financial institutions had dedicated customer service teams who actually developed that specialist knowledge and could respond. We hear far too often from people who are spending hours and hours on the phone to a contact centre or having to travel and go into a branch only to find their meeting, then come into contact with people who don't understand about charities.
That was certainly Dave's experience. In July, UK Finance, which represents banks, set up an online banking guide designed to help charities. Here's what David Raw, its Managing Director of Commercial Finance, told us about this report.
The challenges in terms of dealing with banks stem from the fact that this is a highly regulated environment. That does create challenges for the banks, both in terms of knowing who their customers are, in terms of knowing where the money is coming from, where the money is going to. So that does mean that there are, you know, issues which the banks need to address. That's why we've been working really closely with the charitable sector. So I know the recent report from the Charity Finance Group talked about the banking hub that we have set up. That is designed to aid mutual understanding between the banking sector and between the charities. But look, we know there is more work to do. Our members, ourselves, we are reading these recommendations in full, and we will be, you know, we look forward actually to following up with the charitable sector on these recommendations.
So David Raw there, what kind of discussions then have you been having with banks?
So we've been having lots of conversations. We've been having conversations with UK Finance and worked very closely with them on the creation of the online hub. That's for bank staff to refer to, as well as people from charities to understand. We have 3 times a year, we have a banking forum where people from the retail banks that work with charities can come and we can share in a safe place where they don't have to feel under pressure or under attack, because we want to work with them. We can share what's happening and where we still need to do some work. And we're doing a lot of bilateral conversations with the individual retail banks. One of the things we're doing off the back of our major report is we're preparing separate information for each of the banks named in the narrative to say to them, this is what people said specifically about you. How can we help? How can you help your customers? Mm. And how can we help you with training, with knowledge, with understanding about the charity sector? Charity sector organisations have put a lot of time and effort already into working with UK Finance. We have seen some progress, but really okay. It's not having the impact it needs for the charities who are the ones facing the difficulties.
But is part of the problem that banks have other important priorities? UK Finance also made the point to us that some charities, for example, send money to high-risk parts of the world. So there do have to be lots of checks to comply with regulations. And I suppose if those checks didn't happen, we'd be on this programme asking, well, why did they let that happen?
Absolutely. We completely understand that the banks are a highly regulated sector, as indeed is the charity sector. We think there could be more work between our two regulators, between the regulators of the charity sector and the regulators of the financial services, to make sure we're taking a proportionate approach to risk. Our colleagues at Muslim Charities Forum are doing a particular report, which is coming out in January, that looks into that issue of overseas funding in particular. But we are not, you know, the charity sector has to be able to send money to where its beneficiaries are, where it needs to work to do it, to do what it needs to do. And for some people, that is going to be overseas. There needs to be more understanding from banks and more use of know your client legislation and rules to actually know your client, not just ask them to fill in a huge number of forms.
Claire Mills from Charity Finance Group, thank you very much indeed. Now, a lot of people do donate more to charity at Christmas. What is the best way to give, and how can you make sure you're donating to the real thing? That's what I'll be looking at on Wednesday's Moneybox Live. Email me your questions and your experiences. It's moneybox@bbc.co.uk. Or as always, you can send us a voice note on WhatsApp. It's 03306 783 183. Now, the Scottish Government has promised to scrap the two-child cap on benefits. That was one of the headlines announced by its finance secretary, Shona Robison, in her budget on Wednesday. The cap currently limits the UK-wide payments of universal credit and child tax credit to the first two children in a family. Here's BBC Scotland's political correspondent, Phil Sim, telling Moneybox more about that announcement and what else could change for our Scottish listeners.
The headline-grabbing rabbit-in-the-hat announcement in the Scottish budget was really more of a political promise for future years. The Scottish Government says it's going to mitigate the two-child cap. It's been estimated that the cap costs households over £3,000 per child, but it's not at all clear yet exactly what the Scottish Government plans to do, how they would offset the cap and how much it would cost. The detail is some way off yet. They're working towards making payments in 2026. There is a more immediate impact on income tax, though. Scotland's devolved system has 6 tax bands, ranging from 19% all the way up to 48%. The big announcement wasn't a change in those rates, but some tinkering with the thresholds where they kick in. So Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, has frozen the thresholds for income tax in the rest of the UK until April 2028. But Shona Robison, the Scottish Finance Secretary, she's lifting them for the lower rates in Scotland next year. The practical impact of that is very small. Scots will have at most an extra £15 in their pockets over a year. That's about 4 pence a day. But it means Ms Robinson can say that a majority of Scots, 51%, will pay less in income tax than they would if they lived south of the border. Again, the figures are tiny. Lower earners are about £28 a year better off, and higher earners will pay thousands of pounds more than those living in the rest of the UK. One tax that will be going up is council tax. That was frozen in Scotland last year, but councils will be free to put up local rates as much as they want next spring.
Phil Sim there, and there's more analysis of that budget if you visit the Scotland Politics section of the BBC News website. Now, it's around now that pensioners across the UK would normally start to receive their winter fuel payments of £200 or £300. This year, of course, it's means tested, meaning millions of people will no longer get it. Moneybox has had a huge number of emails from people who don't qualify but are still on a very tight budget and are worried about winter. So all this month, in the run-up to Christmas, we're going to look at the financial support that could still be available to struggling households. We'll start with attendance allowance, a benefit that is available to some pensioners with disabilities or health conditions. Moneybox reporter Dan Whitworth has been looking into it. Dan?
Well, Fliss, some estimates suggest a lot of people who are eligible to claim attendance allowance don't. Now, figures on this are hard to come by. The Department for Work and Pensions told us this year it's forecast to spend £7.7 billion helping 1.5 million people. But one estimate from Policy in Practice, that's kind of like a social company that helps people access benefits, suggests just over 1 million people don't claim it who could. Now, we must say the DWP strongly disputes this figure, and the report's author admits it could be overinflated because it's so hard to accurately gauge the level of care someone needs to get the allowance.
Okay, so how much is it worth and how do you qualify?
Well, you could qualify if you're over state pension age, that's 66 years old, and have a disability or health condition that means you need help, even if just a little bit of help in your home. Things like giving yourself a wash, using the toilet, getting in and out of bed. And it's worth a significant amount of money, £72 a week if you need help in either the day or night, or £108 per week if you need both. It's also, and this is really important for this, it is not means tested.
Right.
So it doesn't matter at all if you've got savings or a big pension. Margaret and Pamela both receive it.
I don't get the heating allowance, so I can now, I don't have to bother about the heating. I put it on when I'm cold. I don't have to, I can do what I want. And also, just recently, I found out because I am getting attendance allowance, I've been refunded 25% off the council tax. £1,400.
I used to get the winter fuel allowance, which helped out, especially in winter time. But that's obviously now that's gone. And that's made a difference because I find that being older and having problems that go along with being older, I do a lot more laundry than I used to do. And that eats money. You know, the dryer eats money, but it still has to be done. When you're in the home all day and you haven't got the ability to move as you used to, you have to be warm. You know, you just have to be warm.
Pamela there. And Margaret before making the point that applying for it can lead to other support, like help with council tax. Dan, if someone's listening and they think they might be eligible, how do they apply?
OK, so you have to fill in a form. I've got it here, 30 pages of it. Now, you can do it online or ask for a paper one like this one to be sent out. And there's a number you can call for that form or to get help. The line is open Monday to Fridays, 8 till 6 p.m. 0800 731 0122 is the number to dial. That number again quickly, 0800 731 0122. Ask for a supporting letter from your GP if you need one. Like I say, it's 30 pages, but don't think you have to fill it in all in one go. One claimant, for example, Fliss, I spoke to, well, she did it over a number of days and in pencil first, so of course, easy to correct any mistakes.
Thanks, Dan. Well, I'm joined now by Ian Greaves, the author of the Disability Rights Handbook for the charity Disability Rights UK. Ian, it's hard to pin down exactly how many people might be missing out on this, but what stops people from claiming?
Well, lots of people think that attendance allowance will adversely affect the benefits that they are already getting, such as pension credits. In fact, the exact opposite is true. If you're getting attendance allowance, you're more likely to get help. It can open up the doors to other types of assistance.
Yes, it's what's called a gateway benefit, isn't it? You can get extra, potentially, pension credit. What else?
Pension credit, yes. You can get extra on housing benefits, council tax benefit as well. Mm. Pension credit in particular. If you're living by yourself, no one claims a benefit called carers allowance for looking after you. You can get an extra £80-odd on top of your pension credit just because you're getting attendance allowance.
Okay, so this is a really useful benefit beyond just the cash of the benefit. So why aren't more people claiming it?
I think there's a tendency for older people to say that they can manage, particularly if they live by themselves. I can manage. I live alone. I don't have a choice. There's a natural pride there. But the thing is, if you have difficulty doing something, if you can only do something very slowly, or you're in pain doing something, or if there's a risk involved in doing something, if you're trying to do it by yourself, then you really do need help. And that's what counts for attendance allowance. It's a need for help, not whether you're getting that help.
Is part of the problem with people not claiming that as we get older, our needs often change quite gradually? People might not consider themselves to have a disability or an additional health need.
That's right. Absolutely. I'm beginning to feel that myself. You think that it's down to age, and it's not, because you've got a disabling condition. And it makes filling out the form quite difficult, because you think, oh, there's 30-odd pages. There's so many questions. I find a better way of actually creating a good picture of what your problems are is to do a diary over 24 hours, listing all the times when you either need help, if you've got that help available, or alternatively, managing by yourself, listing all the times you struggle to do something, when it takes you a long time, if you're doing something with pain, or if you're doing something that's risky. Attach a copy of that diary to the claim form.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned it's a 30-page claim form. And in fact, I'll tell you what, Dan has just lobbed it at me. And it is pretty hefty, isn't it? What other advice might you have for people who are thinking about embarking on this mammoth form?
To be honest, that advice was really, really helpful that you've given earlier. Take your time doing it. Those questions are asked because your opinion is really, really important. But there is help there available. You can contact a local advice centre. You can contact your citizens' advice, and they can help fill out the form. There's also excellent information guides on a fact sheet produced by Age UK. Carers UK have also got a really, really good information guide on attendance allowance.
So there's lots of different charities that can help you. Ian Greaves, thank you very much.
Thank you, Felicity.
Thank you. Now, could you be paying more than you need to because you've insured some things twice? New research suggests that over a third of households with contents cover have also paid for separate policies for specific items. That's often things like mobile phones, washing machines and dishwashers, perhaps because they've been offered cover at the point of purchase. 6,000 people were asked about their insurance products. Their answers were then analysed by researchers at the University of Bristol, who've warned that some of them might be doubling up on cover and should check their policies. Our reporter, Jo Krasner, went to ask people in Liverpool.
Tell me, have you got household insurance?
I have, yeah.
Yes. Buildings and contents.
It's full cover because it was a part of the mortgage, so it's a full cover, any damages.
Just contents I've got at the moment, I think it's 25,000. It does cover things outside the house as well, so if I was out and I lost an item, it's covered.
So would you insure other things separately?
I think there's some things that I've got insured separately. Things like jewellery and expensive things.
And would you know how much you're covered for?
Not off the top of my head, no.
So do you think you've overinsured by taking out insurance that might have been covered in your home insurance?
I'm hoping not, but the insurance documents are quite extensive, so I'm sure I haven't read all the detail.
Could it be, though, that you have taken out more insurance than you need?
Possibly. It could possibly be the case, yeah.
Katie Cross is from the Personal Finance Research Centre at the University of Bristol, which analysed the data. Katie, why do you think some people might be paying twice for cover, and on what kinds of things?
Hi. So we, as you said, conducted a survey on behalf of the Aberdeen Financial Fairness Trust. And as part of that, we spoke to around 6,000 people and asked them about their insurance. And we started by asking them about kind of what insurance they had, things like contents insurance, car insurance, the more general insurances. And from that, we found that older people are more likely to have contents insurance and those who own their own home. And then people who are less likely to have contents insurance were those who were younger or those who are from lower income households. And then we moved on to ask people about, in addition to any contents insurance they may or may not have, did they have any specific items insured on separate policies? And from that, we found that these specific item policies were more likely to be taken out by younger people or those from minority ethnic groups. And then kind of from both of those questions, we were able to see the proportion of people who had both contents insurance and then these kind of specific household items insured separately.
Those people might be at risk then?
Yeah, because we found that over a third of people who had contents insurance then also had insurance on at least one other household item insured separately. And actually around 8% of all households had both contents insurance and at least three other specific policies that they'd taken out. And we're not saying that all of these people are overinsured. There may well be reasons why you would want your contents insurance and then a separate policy. So for example, it might offer you something that your contents insurance isn't already offering you, but they may well be potentially duplicating something that they're already covered for.
Yes, there is a risk. And then paying too much, potentially. Now, you mentioned that the survey was commissioned by a trust that campaigns for low-income households. We're talking about the risk of over-insuring, but not having insurance in the first place is probably more risky for people.
Yeah, so we're not telling people like not to get insurance.
Yes.
So we also found from our survey that around a quarter didn't have any contents insurance or any specific item insurance either. So they would potentially be underinsured or not insured at all. And, you know, lower income households particularly are more likely to be at risk of being in that group. But I guess what we're saying is it's just important to check what you're already covered for. So we're not saying not to have insurance, just that if you are getting a new product and you're thinking about taking out like an extended warranty, for example,
why pay twice?
Just to check. Yeah, yes. Just to check what you're already covered for, definitely.
Now, is this an issue with the insurance industry? Are people not being properly informed? Or is it like some of those people we heard from in Liverpool, are they simply not reading their policies?
So I think it's important really for insurance companies to make sure that their policy documents are easy to read, and there are best practice guides out there already, and I'm sure lots of insurance companies are already doing this, but we would urge them to make sure that it is written in plain English and it's easy to understand what people are and aren't getting. But then equally, it is very important for people to go back and check. Like, it's quite easy to forget what we're already insured on. You know, you might take your contents insurance out years ago and just auto renew, and then, you know, when you're buying a new product, you just think, oh, that sounds good.
People aren't reading these documents every day just for pleasure. And of course, some people as well might not realize they have cover that comes with a packaged bank account. So like travel or phone insurance, they could potentially be paying twice as well. The Association of British Insurers told us it always recommends reading policy documents to understand the extent of your cover, especially if you're considering buying another policy, and to speak to your insurer if you're unclear. Katie Cross, thank you very much. Well, if you want to double up on the Moneybox podcast, we certainly encourage that. Our whole back catalogue is available right now on BBC Sounds, including our episode looking at financial abuse earlier this week. I'm back in our next pod talking about charity and how to be confident that you're giving to a genuine cause. If you want to contact us about a money issue in your life, then please do. You can email moneybox@bbc.co.uk. You can also send a voice note or comment to Moneybox on WhatsApp. The number is 03306 783 183. Today, the reporters were Dan Whitworth and Joe Krasner, researcher Emma Smith, studio manager Cameron Ward. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Felicity Hannah, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds.
The Reith Lectures 2024, hosted by me, Anita Arnand.
The series is about the complexity of human violence. All violence is not the same, and all violence perpetrators are not the same.
Four questions about violence, explored by the forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Gwen Adshead.
By listening to perpetrators, we can learn more about the genesis of violence, and perhaps particularly where we might be able to intervene to reduce the risk of violence happening in the future.
The Reith Lectures from BBC Radio 4. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.